will be in order. Today's date, Tuesday, January 20th, 2015. So we will today be having an overview by Minsku, whereby they will report on the biennial budget requirements that were put in law last session. In addition, Minsku will talk about their performance metrics, which also were last session. So really, this is an opportunity for the hard work of the legislature and the systems when we say this is what we want to accomplish in the next biennium, for them to come back and say, this is how we did, this is what happened. So thank you for being here. And at this time, I would call Laura King and Craig Schoeniger forward, as I believe they will be our presenters.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's a delight to be here. This is my first time in the building, and so I was mystified to see a whole new corridor on the lower level. It's very exciting to watch what's happening. Such a gorgeous old building.
Well, Dr. King, exciting is one word for it.
I don't live here. I get to go home, so I appreciate that distinction, Madam Chair. But thank you for the invitation. With me, as mentioned by the chair, is Craig Schoeniger, who is our Senior System Director for Research, and Deb Bednarz, who is our System Director of Financial Planning and Analysis. What we'd like to do is provide some background on the work of our 31 colleges and universities and walk through the statutory reporting requirements that were in session law in 2013. We'll also provide some additional background concerning who our students are and, of course, repeat for you the performance reporting results that were shared with you last session, but we're delighted to have an occasion to do that again today. So if that's agreeable, what I'd like to do is turn to Craig and ask him to walk through the performance results.
Very good. And also, members, I just want to remind you, the Senate worked really hard on the performance metrics. Some of the other more detailed reporting requirements came from House provisions that Chair Pawlowski felt strongly about. And so we're going to do a deeper dive into some of the detail than we had really worked on last session. But we appreciate the chance to do that, and we're looking forward to the performance metric results.
Terrific. Thank you, ma'am.
Chair Bonoff, senators and staff, as you'd indicated, the 2013 Appropriations Act included five performance measures for the system, and those performance measures were tied to receipt of 5% of our state appropriations in 2015. And the system was able to achieve four of those five performance measures, performance goals, and so we were able to receive that 5%.
Excuse me one moment, Mr. Schoeniger. I just want to, members, you've got a handout in your packet entitled Minnesota Management and Budget, and that identifies what we're talking about. Good.
The first goal was to increase graduates or degrees, diplomas, and certificates by 4%. The colleges and universities were able to increase graduates by 12% and degrees, diplomas, and certificates by 10% between 2010 and 2013. Second goal was to increase our second fall persistence and completion rate by 1 percentage point. Although we didn't achieve that 1% increase, we did see a modest increase of 0.1% in that rate. The third goal was to increase our related employment rate of graduates. That's data that's based on a survey of graduates to see if they've found jobs that are related to their programs. The goal was to increase that rate by 4%. We saw a 5.9% increase in that rate between the 2010 graduates and the 2012 graduates. Fourth goal was to formulate a plan to reduce students' expenses by expanding the use of open educational resources. And we have indeed developed that plan and are in the process this fiscal year of implementing that plan. The fifth goal was to reallocate $22 million in resources in fiscal 14, and there again we achieved that goal with a reallocation of $29 million. So So that completes a quick review of those five measures and our performance on them.
So let's, members, let's take some time for questions with regard to that. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you clarify for me a little bit on performance measure 4 on the open educational resources? I can't tell from this letter if the requirement was just to formulate the plan, which I think is in place now, but you said it hasn't been implemented yet. And I didn't know if that 1% reduction was required as part, you know, if that 1% reduction was required in order to count this measure as having been fulfilled. I don't see a timeline on here for that 1% reduction in expenses.
Mr. Seneca.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, the requirement was to develop a plan that would ultimately reduce students' expenses, and we have been implementing that plan. It's already being implemented. We haven't done any measurement on the impact on students' expenses. That's a fairly challenging thing to measure because we have to determine what exactly students are spending for books and supplies. The thinking here is, open educational resources are resources that students can access without cost or conceivably access with a much lower cost. And so in order to know for sure that those expenses have been reduced, we would need to measure, you know, what students are actually spending on all of their resources, whether they buy them from the campus bookstore or on the web. So our focus has really been to try to track the use of those resources with the expectation that that is going to reduce students' expenses.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Just a follow-up, please. Thank you. So when do you anticipate that you might be able to collect that measurement? Or I think what I might hear you say is that maybe the legislature, maybe we need to redefine or relook at how we talk about better use of open educational resources. I think what I hear you saying is the way that we have the criteria laid out now, it's very difficult, and I just would like you to talk about that. If you think you will be able to adequately measure that criteria, or if you think some changes are needed, it's an important criteria, and if so, what kind of changes would you recommend?
Mr. Seneker.
Chair Bonoff, Senator Nelson, we certainly will be measuring the extent of use of open resources as well as the extent to which our faculty are using open source textbooks, which is another way to really a subset of open educational resources, textbooks that are available without cost. And so we will be measuring the extent to which that is growing among our faculty, among our students, to get some sense of what the impact might be on students' book and supply expenses.
And so,
Senator Nelson?
Oh, I'll let it go for now, but I think we need some more work on, I need some more clarification on how to better understand that we're actually getting those savings for students, and I'm sure we'll discuss that through the session.
And
thank
Senator
you.
Nelson, we will have some committee time where we'll identify what the next biennium's performance metrics are, and so if you want to give some thought to that, we can look at putting that as more defined as part of the next package.
Thank you so much.
Yep, thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Claussen and then Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schoenecker, I'm curious about goal number one, and congratulations. I mean, you really topped that one off quite well as far as what the metric was and where you achieved. The question that I have is, are we aligning those degrees, diploma certificates to our workforce needs? In other words, the fastest growing occupation set in the state has to do with health careers. And when you look at those diplomas, degrees, and certificates, how many actually were in that area? Do we have any information that shows that we are aligning those educational attainments to the workforce needs?
Mr. Seneca.
Chair Bonoff, Senator Claussen, in a number of ways, we have been working to align our you know, production of graduates of degrees, diplomas, and certificates with workforce needs. We went through a series of listening sessions with employers across 8 industries that are key industries in Minnesota to understand what their needs were. We certainly could present information about the degrees, diplomas, and certificates at a more detailed level that would give a sense of the fields. But we're very much engaged in working with employers to make sure we're expanding programs where there are critical workforce needs.
Madam Chair?
Senator.
Thank you. Mr. Schoenacker, I'd be very interested in seeing a further breakdown if I could, please.
Certainly, we can provide
Thank
that.
You.
Yeah, and I'm sure the rest of the committee would like to see that, too. So that would be great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, we'll provide it to your office.
And Thank you, and we'll distribute it.
Certainly.
Great. Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schoenacker, thank you for this update. I'm new to this committee, and so my question is, in lieu of the only goal that was not attained by the Minsky system, number two, can you give me a little background as maybe high level of why that was and some context of why that wasn't achieved, and just to understand the dynamics there, and are you planning to meet it moving forward? How are you planning to achieve it moving forward?
Mr. Schoenacker.
Chair Bonoff, Senator Franzen, certainly, and I think that's something we'll get into somewhat more detail on a subsequent slide where we talk about graduation and transfer out rates. But that measure is a measure of we identify the entering group of students each fall, and then a year later, how many are still enrolled or have transferred or have already earned, say, a one-year certificate from that institution where they started. That is a key priority for our system. We have a number of initiatives underway to improve that second fall rate and ultimately our completion rates. I mean, one of the areas of focus is making sure our students have adequate resources to pursue their education. Another big area of focus is working on the readiness of our students as they come to us. Students that aren't college ready, that need to take developmental courses when they start, generally have lower persistence rates and ultimately lower completion rates. So there are a number of strategies we're pursuing to identify the students that are at risk, provide them with services, improve their readiness, and then the broader strategies to try to improve their financial resources so that we can have a larger percentage of our entering students that move through and complete their educational goals.
Thank you. Madam Chair, if you're going to go into more detail later, I'll reserve my questions so then.
On the same note, though, Mr. Schoenacker, I have a question. I'm trying to understand the disconnect between, you know, such strong outcomes in number one, to have a 12% increase in graduate degrees and a 10% increase in diplomas, and yet the lack of persistence. How do you graduate that many if they're not persisting?
Chair Bonoff, a couple of ways to think about that contrast between degrees and persistence rates. The degrees would be essentially looking farther back in time. We had tremendous enrollment growth during the recession, peak enrollment in fiscal year 2011. And so that larger number of students is working its way through. And so as we get to fiscal 12 and fiscal 13, we see many more students are graduating, earning those degrees, diplomas, and certificates. So that's one of the reasons behind that big increase in graduation. Persistence rates, the second fall persistence, for example, is just looking a year back at the students that have entered more recently. And I mean, basically, I would say a change in the rate of a tenth of a point, which is what we experienced, essentially is a stable rate. We didn't go up. The goal was a one-point increase. That would be a very substantial increase in our rate. We typically don't see that kind of an increase over a short period of time. But it's really a more recent entering cohort where we're seeing more stability and persistence.
And Mr. Schoenacker, just for the education of the committee, could you remind us what your current completion rates are?
The completion rates measured 3 years after entry for students at our colleges, which includes either graduation or if they've transferred out to another institution, are on the order of 53%.
Okay.
The completion rates at the university, which includes essentially graduation, are about 53%, but that's measured 6 years after entry for a bachelor's degree.
Mr. Schoenacker, I'm not certain that that's the exact figure for the university, but we'll get that because I had heard that it was higher than that right now, but we'll get that on Thursday. But thank you very much for that. Other questions on the performance metrics? Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just wondering, as far as 1 and 3, it seems that a lot of that was due to just natural changes then, the number of students that were moving through. And then also, as far as the employment, I mean, obviously, the economy is improving as well. Could you comment on that, whether you think that it's just part of some natural changes in the overall economy and the demographics?
Chair Bono,
Mr. Schoenecker.
Senator Eakin, certainly that's a factor. The numbers of students we serve, the trends over time are a significant influence, and also the economy. As we've looked at our enrollment, the state's unemployment rate is one of the most significant predictors of our enrollment in aggregate. We looked at the data over the last 20 years. And so certainly we've seen that related employment rate vary some with the overall state employment rate. But I think the other factor that I suspect is part of that growth is our much more intensive work with employers to identify. It's not only identifying the programs where they need graduates, but what are the key skills that they are looking for in graduates, and us making sure that those programs are providing those skills to students. So I think there's a multitude of factors that are behind these trends that we're showing.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schoenecker, can you repeat number 2, please, what the attainment rate was there?
Yes. The goal for our persistence and completion rate, and that is 1 year after entry, what proportion of the full-time students are still pursuing their goals. The goal was to increase that by 1 full point. It actually increased by about 0.1 point.
Anything else, Senator Claussen?
Are you ready, Madam Chair, for me to continue?
And I think Senator Claussen had a follow-up.
Just a follow-up. Could you relate that to goal number 1, then?
That's what I did.
You just did that?
That's what I did.
That?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's all right.
I'm just
do it again. No.
Slow processing here.
I had the same. I was like, how's that disconnect? How is that? Yeah. So go ahead, Mr. Schoenecker.
Try to do it differently.
Okay, Chair Bonoff, Senator Claussen. Number 1 is really in large part driven by our increase in students. We had the economy put a lot of people out of work, or they were underemployed, and so a much larger number of students came to our colleges and universities looking for credentials, looking for additional skills during a period when employment was sort of at an ebb. And so that group of students kind of worked its way through the system, and we had a parallel increase in the number of graduates, degrees, diplomas, and certificates. What the second measure is saying is that on average, what percentage of the students who come one fall are continuing the next fall. And clearly our goal is to increase that rate, do better at retaining students, at helping them meet their objectives, earn their degrees or certificates. But what we found in this time frame is that rate really didn't change from one fall to the next fall. So we've got sort of a comparable percentage of students coming back, but because we had more students coming in a couple years earlier, our degrees, diplomas, and certificates increased.
Thank you.
Thank you. One last thing before we move on. Members, with regard to the number 5, the reallocation of $22 million, that was a pretty aggressive goal. And if you look at in your packet, unless you're going to go through
we'll
this.
We'll get to it.
Okay,
yep.
Good. Because I wanted to make sure that members would get to see the detail on that. Perfect. So I'll leave that for
terrific.
You. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've got a fair number of slides here to move through in order to respond to your request that we provide you information on the statutory reporting requirement that was in the 2013 session law. So we'll progress through those requirements. Just a format note for you. If the title has a number in it, that corresponds to the section of the law. So that if you're following alongside the session law, we tried to build the presentation so that the information is presented in the same order. if there's not a number in the title, it's a slide we added to clarify or expand or otherwise more completely convey the information. So with that, I'm gonna just jump here. First of all, as background, and we have many returning members, so you probably all are quite familiar with this, but what you'll see here in a few minutes is the financial and enrollment information that relates to the 410,000 students that we serve at our 24 community and technical colleges and 7 state universities located across the state. We are, as you know, the largest provider of higher education, including continuing education and customized training in the state. With your support, we're serving as the fifth largest system of higher education in the country. We serve students that are just still in high school, that are right out of high school, that are adult learners, or workers and professionals that are updating their skills and preparing for their next career advancement. This includes 112,000 online students, 52,000 first-generation students, 11,000 veterans, 99,000 low-income students, 82% of all of the PSEO students in the state. And I just would note that when we talk about serving students in these categories, our colleges and universities serve more of these students than all the other providers in Minnesota combined. So that gives you some sense of the scale of our organization. 6 out of 10 of our students are in outstate Minnesota. So we are very evenly distributed between the metropolitan area and all the four corners of the state. Craig mentioned earlier in his remarks about goal number one and the trend in enrollment moving through the data. You can see that here on this next slide. You can see on the top line the total enrollment, and that sloped very strongly up from 2007 to 2011. The middle line, the blue line, is our credit-based enrollment, and that moved right along with total enrollment, as did our non-credit enrollment. So we wrote a very strong enrollment increase up 5 or so years ago. We ran pretty steady at the same number for a couple of years, and here just in the last couple of years, we've started to give back some of that gain. We always are studying our enrollment and what's driving it, helping our colleges and universities prepare predictors for enrollment, and a study completed by Craig's team finds that there are really 4 factors that are very strongly correlated with our enrollment trends. High school graduation rates, the size of the adult population from 25 to 34, the state's unemployment rate, and the change in the state's median household income. Those 4 things, while I'm not going to tell you they're causal, they're certainly coincident with what's going on with enrollment.
Excuse me, Dr. Yes, King. Yep, Senator Pratt.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quick, the difference between credit and non-credit?
Certainly, Madam Chair and Senator Pratt, non-credit instruction is typically under contract with employers to do on-site training, largely on-site training. We have about 6,000 businesses around Minnesota that are in contracts with our colleges and universities to provide training to their current employees, and they're not interested in credit-based training. They want particular skills that are dialed right into what their right in front of them requirements are. So we call that non-credit training, and it's a substantial part of our business and has been for years. It started out in the technical college community years ago, and it's now moved into the community and state university environment as well.
Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick follow-up. So as we're talking, just so I can get my arms around some of the rates, when we talk about graduation rate, participation rate, does that include the non-credit students, or is that strictly just to the credit students?
Mr. Shoniker.
Chair Bonoff, Senator Pratt. Measures like persistence rates, completion rates, graduation rates would be applied to credit students. Those are students who are taking courses that typically would apply to a degree, diploma, or certificate, whereas the non-credit courses would not apply to any sort of a credential. They're much more focused on the skills and the knowledge that employers or employees are seeking.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Oh, Senator Nelson.
I'll just be very brief, Madam Chair, but I don't want to get too far from the slide that talked about your enrollment and seven universities and then the other technical and two-year colleges. Do you know what the what percent of your students are in those seven universities?
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, it's about a third, and on a FYE basis. 53,000 FYE at the universities, and so that would leave us with about 100,000 at the two-year schools.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that relationship has held pretty constant over the years.
Thank you.
Moving then to the next graph, you'll just see an illustration of the undergraduate enrollment in Minnesota. You all have seen this before, but we include it here for your background. So with that as a sort of a preamble, what I'd like to do, Madam Chair, is ask Deb Bednarz to start moving through the statutory reporting, and we'll get as far as we're able.
Very good. Ms. Bednarz.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. My name is Deb Bednarz, and I work with the Finance Division with Vice Chancellor King. Can everyone hear me? Okay.
Yes. Want me to drive?
Okay. The next set of slides that you're going to see illustrate the information that was reported as part of our biennial budget proposal, and it is in compliance with Minnesota Statute 135A.031, Subdivision 7. So as noted earlier, the numbers in the upper left-hand corner of the slide actually refer to the statutory site. So what we're looking at now refers to Subdivision 7, the first piece of information that was required in that. So it helps you track if you have the report in front of you. We reported this information, the statute directed us to report a five-year history of system-wide expenditures by object of expenditure and functional classification. We reported this information based on our audited financial statements for fiscal 09 to fiscal 13. The spending in the report totals the operating expenses reported on our financial statements. The data includes all funds, so it's an all-fund spending picture. And if you go to our audited financial statements, you'll be able to track back to the information in these reports as well as additional financial information. So it's very much, you can find additional information by going to our audited financial statements.
So Ms. Bednarz, on that point, we, in comparing from the report on page 3 with this, it does look like there was a pretty large jump in auxiliary expenses, $100 million increase over 5 years. Can you provide examples of what type of work and why that significant increase?
Yes, and I can also explain one of the very important point when you're looking at data from 09 and comparing it to the other years. The way we are required to report data actually changed between 09 and 10. So it had to do with how we report cost of goods sold, and so it increased the spending and the revenues in all categories. So when we do comparison, when I'm looking at comparison, I'm actually looking at 10 through 13. We have gone back at some, it's very hard to go back and adjust it to that level of detail. So it is something to keep in mind when you're looking at the data.
Yep. But then, Ms. Bednarz, if you look at auxiliary, I can see that big jump between 2009 and 2010 based on reporting, mm-hmm. but then it continues to have a pretty substantial jump between 2010 and 2011, and I would assume at that point it's the similar reporting?
Yes, that would be similar reporting.
So what would account for that jump?
Madam Chair, I would have to dig more deeply, but my off-the-top-of-my-head estimate is that it's related to the occupancy rates in the dorms.
Mm. Gotcha.
As occupancy rates fluctuate, food service costs fluctuate, laundry service costs fluctuate, et cetera. But we will dig into that.
Thanks.
We also brought several parking ramps online, or at least one parking ramp between 12 and 13. That would explain part of the difference. I would point out to you that the bottom line hardly moved between 10 and 13, a change from $1.835 billion to $1.857 billion. So there's movement going on here that's not increasing the bottom line.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, it might be helpful just to give a quick definition of auxiliary expenses.
Please do.
Because it helps to know what we're talking about when we talk about these different categories, and sometimes they can be confusing. So auxiliary enterprises include expenses that are related to any kind of enterprise activity, and this includes residence halls, food services, student union, college stores, student health services. And they exist to furnish goods or services primarily to students, faculty, and staff, and they're usually a charge of a fee related to that goods or service provided. So that's the type of activity in there. And the other thing I'd like to point out in this reporting by functional category, these are IPEDS reporting categories. So what it allows us to do, they're national reporting standards that we follow, that we're required to follow, so that you can compare our results with other colleges and universities throughout the nation. So it's a nice way to report data in a functional classification.
Thank you. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, you know, for me, instruction, research, and scholarships categories are kind of, I understand, the rest I do not. Is it possible for you to give us, you just read the definition for auxiliary
today,
enterprises?
Yes.
Could you give us a little bit of
Yes, I'd be happy to. I have it in my notes.
On the other
and
ones.
We could send you the copy that we have that gives a summary as well, so you'll have
Thank
it
you
handy.
Very much. Thank you,
So for
Ms.
academic...
Bednar. Keep going.
Oh, okay, for academic support, it includes expenditures for support services that are part of a mission, including research, library expenditures, museums, academic computing, which includes distance learning, academic administration, which includes the dean, personnel development, and course and curriculum development. Would it be helpful if I walk through these?
I think that's what Senator Torres-Ray asked, is if you could read them. And I heard that you're going to also send them to us so members can have it in writing.
Okay. This is system. This is for the whole system. It's
Yes.
Then it's distributed to the various campuses, this academic support.
Correct. Ms. Bednarz, Vice Chancellor King.
If I might, Madam Chair and Senator, not quite. What you have here is the sum of all the individual schools. So you'll see Mankato's academic support spending in this number, St. Cloud State's academic support spending. We don't have academic support spending, I don't think, in the system office. It occurs on the campuses.
Instruction is our most significant category of spending, and it includes all faculty salary and fringe benefits for direct instruction. It includes department chairs, lab assistants, specific program-specific software, and equipment. So it's very directly related to instruction. For student services, that's expenditures related to admission, register activities, any activities that's related to a student's emotional and physical well-being, and to their intellectual and cultural and social development. That would be include career guidance, counseling, financial aid administration, intramural athletics, and student organization, and intercollegiate athletics as well. And then institutional support includes expenditures for the day-to-day operation and support of the institution, including general administrative services, planning, and executive direction, administrative computing, so that's system-wide administrative functions, so our accounting systems and general systems of that nature, legal and fiscal operations, and public relations and development. So,
thank you for that clarification.
Any other questions on this? You can see that our largest category of spending is instruction, followed by academic support and student services. So the next slide that we have to show you also relates to the 7.1 reporting requirement, but this shows spending in a little bit different way. It looks at operating expenses by object of expenditure. And this, as you can see, our largest expenditure item is salary and benefits, and they account for 67% of our total spending. Purchase services make up approximately 12% of spending, supplies 8%, depreciation 6%, repairs and maintenance 2%, and net financial aid is 2%. And net financial aid is the money that comes through us but then gets sent out to students for like their living expenses. So a certain amount of financial aid gets applied to tuition, gets applied to fees, books, and then the rest is transferred to the students for their living expenses. I just want to have a quick note about supplies and purchase services. These are very, very large categories of expenditures. Purchase services includes IT maintenance and support, software purchases and rental licensing, utilities, trash and snow removal, law enforcement, security services, professional and technical services, legal services, printing, advertising, and travel. So it's a pretty wide category of spending. And supplies, you may think, well, that's a lot in supplies, but supplies is actually also a very broad category. It includes items classified as supplies for financial reporting purposes, and that includes what is equipment purchased as supplies. So it's equipment that's been purchased but is not depreciated. So it includes any equipment that we purchase that's under $10,000. It includes some software purchases, laboratory supplies, general supplies, and for cleaning and office supplies. So it's another large category that we have. Any questions about?
Anything you want to say about the way you calculate instructional expenditures per full year equivalent?
Yes. Yep. That's the next slide here.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. And that's, well, to do it. So now we're moving on to look at costs in a slightly different way, and that's the instructional expenditures per full year equivalent. So it's like spending on instruction per student. Think of it that way. And this data corresponds to the subdivision 7.2 in the statutory language. And each year, the system conducts an instructional cost study by college and university, by program, and by level of instruction. So it's quite a detailed undertaking. And the chart that you see here are the averages of each level of instruction for the system on a full year equivalent basis for fiscal 13. The lower division direct instruction cost per student, per FYE, full-time student, is $3,985. For upper division, it's $5,492. And for graduate, which includes master's and doctoral, it's $6,664 per FYE. And as we noted, these only represent the direct instructional expenses, which includes faculty compensation, department chairs and coordinators, lab assistants, and equipment and supplies and other specific program costs. So these are direct instructional costs per FYE. In general, we find that the more technical programs have a higher cost per FYE than a general education or liberal arts programs. And the next slide that we're showing gives another view of what MinSKU looks like in terms of those different categories. So it helps to illustrate the level of activity in each of these categories. And as you can see, the majority of our instructional activity is in lower division, which tends to be the lower cost in compared to the upper division and the graduates on a per FYE basis. So 82% of our activity is actually in the lower division, 15% in upper division, and then 3% in the graduate. So kind of reflects the students that we serve. Next slide, we're moving on to look at revenues. And this is fiscal 13 data, and it corresponds to subdivision 7.3 in the statute. This pie chart shows the distribution of fiscal 13 revenues from an audited all funds perspective. And as the chart illustrates, tuition is the largest source of funding for the MinSKU system, followed by state appropriation. So as you think about MinSKU and our funding sources, we like to say that really the two main drivers of our funding source are state appropriation and tuition. One important thing to keep in mind when you're looking at the slides is that it does represent that all fund perspective. And some of the revenue that's in there is just not flexible funding. So it's dedicated for certain activities only. For example, the revenue fund revenues must support revenue fund projects, and federal grants are often provided for a specific set of activities.
excuse me, Ms. Bednarz, you know, we made a significant investment for fiscal year 14 and 15. Have you personally calculated the percentages as the state appropriation tuition relationship?
We have, and we have a slide that shows that because we want to talk about that relationship and how it's changing over time. So that's one of our additional slides. It's, you'll see it in the next few minutes or so. So here's the relationship between state appropriation and tuition on a per FYE basis. So this is looking at the two main sources of support for our operating, which is state appropriation and tuition. And you could see how it changes over time. In 2002, the state appropriation accounted for approximately two-thirds and tuition approximately one-third of the total. By fiscal 12 and 13, tuition accounted for 60% and state appropriation accounted for 40%. And that mirrors the aggregate trend that we're going to show in the next slide. So here's a chart that may look familiar to you. We show it often, and we call it the cross chart. And it takes a closer look at our two main funding sources, state appropriation and tuition. And it shows a relationship between state appropriation and tuition over time. The appropriation is shown in blue, and the tuition amount is shown in red. And as this chart illustrates, as the state reduced its support for higher education, students bore a greater share of the cost. But this past biennium, the tuition freeze accompanied by higher levels of state support resulted in the improvement of that relationship, and it's a trend that we hope continues. So you can really see how it's changed the past since 2002, the relationship between tuition and appropriation.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just very puzzled by this graph. When you talk about relationship, could you tell me what that means? So the institution relies on this appropriation that either comes, these funds that either come from tuition or state appropriation. And it varies. You know, obviously, you went in 2013 up to 60%, 60.4 reliance on tuition. And then it was as low as 39% on reliance on appropriation from the state. It seems like now you're at 52.547. So that variation kind of makes sense to me. Of course, you know, if you have less money, then your tuition goes up. But could you expand on how that changes any dynamic internally? Is it means that when you have a higher reliance on appropriation, tuitions ultimately do go down and a percentage that reflects that? Or could you explain what these graphs actually mean?
Certainly. Senator, I apologize that they're not explaining themselves more clearly. And you'll see in a couple slides forward a discussion about the tuition relationship particularly. But I think the point we're trying to convey is that we really hold hands between what happens with tuition and what happens with the state support. Because those are our principal sources of revenue to pay for instruction. As the state, and you can see this from 2002 to 2012, if you follow the blue line, as the state contribution levels went down, and they did in absolute terms and in percentage terms, we were faced with, and our enrollment was going up, we were faced with a question about whether we raise tuition to replace that state support or we limit access so that we didn't have to raise tuition. So it's very much a handshake relationship. You'll see in a couple slides that for all of the increases we've had in tuition in the last 10 years, our total spending per FYE has gone down, which tells me that we've controlled costs even though we've had to raise tuition to replace state appropriation reductions. So it's a very closed circle.
Madam Chair.
Senator Torres-Ray.
I do understand that, and the graph does tell me that.
Okay.
So they go ahead. What it doesn't tell me as a legislator is what happens as a result of my decision when I increase the funding, right? So you're telling me that we increased the appropriation starting on 2013. Obviously, the graph went up, right? So what happened in the institution is what is unclear to me. The cost, did the cost go up so that you use that dollars to pay for the cost of instruction? So what is right. not revealed in your graph, I understand that these two go together. If one goes down, well, you have to elevate the other. But now we put more money into the system. So the graph is telling me that we are going in a direction where you have more reliance on That's the right. appropriation of the state. So did you use those dollars to address cost, or did we lower tuition? What happens when we make a decision that changes that equation is what is not clear in here. I understand they go together. If I make one decision to increase one, well, you're going to have to make a decision to decrease the other. That part I do understand. The other part, what happens as a consequence of that is what this doesn't have, any of these graphs actually have.
Madam Chair and
Vice
Senator,
Chancellor King.
With apologies for that. If we go to the next, I guess we don't have it here. We have a slide that illustrates exactly the answer, I think. And what that slide shows us is that without regard to the shift between state support and tuition, as our revenue has moved, our spending has gone down. We are spending less per student than we were 7 or 8 years ago. With the state support, with cost controls, with efficiencies, the Senator opened talking about reallocations. The state support last year enabled us to not raise tuition and still manage to balance budgets accordingly. So it had an impact, absolutely.
Senator Sharon.
Yes, I where I go is back to slide 7-1. I don't know what the slide is. I don't know the page. It's the one where you were talking about the operating expenditures by function and the operating expenses by object of expenditure. And that has to be seen in relationship to what Senator Tories Ray is talking about, because when you take a look at your expenses by object of expenditure, how much control do you have? How much does the system have control over those objects? So salaries and benefits, for example, is a negotiated agreement, right?
Madam Chair and Senator,
Dr. King.
The percentages of the slices of the pie on the object of expenditure pie chart have been pretty stable over the years. As we've cut budgets, we've cut these relationships pretty proportionally, and as budgets have grown, they've grown. They're a little lumpier going up because we don't have to hire, you know, it like this. We hire more like this.
But what I'm saying is that if you take a look at the operating expenses by object, if you had a comparison, you'd be able to see the what happens when we either increase payments to the Minsky system, how it affects your expenses by object of expenditure.
And Senator Sharon, excuse me for 1 second. If you open your Minnesota State Colleges and Universities packet right here, page 3, it does actually list their categories and then compares them year over year.
Yes,
Yep, and it is very helpful. And I had asked that question because I had noticed the spike, or my staff noticed the spike in auxiliary services and supplies, and so had received some explanation on that. But it is really interesting to look over that, and I appreciate the line of questioning. Any other questions on that? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Bonoff. And my questions are a little similar to my colleagues, and it's about that one, it's like that missing piece of information that's going to tie it all together. And the piece that, as I can understand it, we do understand the correlation between tuition and state aid, but the piece that seems to be missing is that total spending in light of this graph. And I realize total spending isn't probably the best
metric either, because your enrollment varies. So I've thought about it in this terms, and if this makes sense in something that you can get, this is the information that would really help me. And that would look at the state appropriation divided by the number of full-time students plus the tuition for a full-time student. To me, that would look like total spending, and that's what I would like to see. What is that total spending when we talk about the tuition for a full-time student and adding on the state aid as for a full-time student? I'm sure it's not that simple, but that gets to the gist of what I'd like to see.
Madam Chair and Senator, if you could page 5 of the I understand members have this in front of them. If you turn to page 5 of this document, is exactly the question you're asking. What you see on page 5 is state appropriation, tuition, fees, other revenues in total between 2009 and 2013. That number has increased from 1795 to 1889. If you'd like it in per FYE expression, we can certainly do that.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Senator Nelson.
Ms. King, that's exactly the one piece that's missing on here is by the full-time student. So thank you so much. I will look forward to that.
And Vice Senator King, just one more thing on that subject. We do have within your packet a comparison of tuition rates across compared nationally as well as the border states. Are you going to address that in your slides?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Gets at some of the questions you've been talking about in terms of
and Ms. Bednarz, could you talk more into the microphone?
So this slide also gets at some of the issues that you've been talking about. What is the student or the state support per FYE? So what's the per student? It takes into account the enrollment piece of that on a full year equivalent student. So state support for our colleges and universities has increased significantly during the 2014-15 biennium. But state funding for the current biennium, it now totals $1.21 billion and a 10.9% increase than what we received over the prior biennium. But as the chart above shows, even the boost in state support in fiscal 14 and 15 per FYE funding remains 32% below 2002 funding levels in inflation-adjusted dollars. So that takes into account the value of money over time. Any questions on that? So it shows, see how it's gone down, and then it's increased in the most recent 2 years.
Madam Chair, then, if you're ready, I'll transition to a new topic. All right. Moving then to the next section of the statute, which asks us to describe how we allocate your support. So it's a little bit of a gear shift. These next slides correspond to subdivision 4 of the statute, and I will walk through them. I don't recall this committee having had this presentation before, so it may well be new information to you. You may hear us talk about the allocation framework, and that is the name that we've given to the algorithm that we use to distribute state support to the colleges and universities. This was developed in 1999 with some revisions in 2006, implemented over time with some interruptions because of big, strong state budget reductions that were kind of shocking to the system. So it's been running now for about 10 years. It was developed through a campus-led group of principals. About 175 people were involved from all of our campuses, and they worked to design a model that accommodated the goals that you see on the slide, which are the principles that the board set out. Foremost was to recognize the diversity of the system. We have, as Craig has mentioned, we have everything from certificates to doctoral programs, and we needed an allocation process that would recognize that unique environment. We wanted a framework that recognized enrollment, cost of instruction, national benchmark data, and other institutional data. And so that's what we have. It's been running now very quietly for about 5 years, and it's the vehicle that we use to distribute the in fiscal 15, the $466 million of state support. It runs through what we refer to as five boxes, and this is what we call the framework. In 2015, $622 million was distributed through this system. $43 million was part of the system-wide set-asides. $23 million was allocated to the colleges and universities as priority funds. $521 million, the vast majority of the resources were allocated through the in the institutional base allocation provision, and $33 million was allocated to support the system office. Each of these boxes has separate algorithms that run and result in an allocation to the college or university. Looking just at the institutional base allocation box, this is where 83% of the state resources are distributed, and it has five features to it: instruction, state student and institutional support, facilities, library, and research and public service. This is a very data-driven model. There's very little of what I call a human intervention variable contained in the model. It runs off cost data, it runs off revenue data, and it runs off national benchmark data. It's very transparent. All of the work papers are on our website. The colleges all see the work papers. They all have an opportunity to participate in proofing the work. And we have something called a technical advisory committee, which receives requests from the campuses for us to take a look at something to see if it's still behaving the way we thought it was supposed to behave, and to do some periodic tuning if need be. It's important to note, though, that the board's position doesn't require the campuses to spend the money in these boxes. This is the mechanism we use to build an allocation to them, but they have 100% delegated authority to spend the money any way they wish once it gets to their campuses.
So that was actually my question, is how is this what determines how much goes to each campus? And the answer is yes.
That's correct, Madam Chair. This is what determines how much goes to each campus, but the campus determines how they spend it once they receive it.
And Vice Chancellor King, you had in an earlier slide said that you use this formula to allocate the state appropriation. You would also, I presume, put the tuition in the same basket?
No, ma'am.
So where does the
tuition dollars don't get anywhere near St. Paul. Tuition dollars are collected on the campus and they stay on the campus. There's no reallocation of tuition revenue within the system whatsoever.
Just an editorial, when we went to all of our campuses, when we did our campus visits, we never heard one complaint about your formula. You know, I expected to, because the systems would complain they didn't have enough money, and then I'd say, well, are you getting your fair share? Do you believe in the formula? And they would always say, oh, I have no complaints about the formula. So I don't know how you did that, but...
Well, one of the things, Madam Chair, that we spent years saying is that we don't have a means to print more money. The only means we have is to allocate the resources that the state provides us. And I think eventually that got through. It is a very vetted process. And the CFOs and the CAOs and the presidents, too, have... This has changed recently, and we've talked about it at the staff level. The CAOs and the CFOs have very good knowledge of it. The presidents did, but the presidents have turned over a lot in the last 5 years. And we've talked about maybe spending some time with presidents to bring them into the fold on what this is all about, because that helps as well. But I'm glad to hear that, Madam Chair, because we've worked hard over the years to build consensus and concurrence on the methodology. So I will leave that unless there are any questions about the allocation process and go back to Deb to pick up on the next section of the statute.
In the budget report statute, subdivision 7.5 concerns reallocations, and we reported on reallocations earlier. They were one of our performance measures, and we reached our reallocation goal. Reallocation is the assignment of resources to a different purpose from the one originally assigned. Reallocation includes both the reassignment of resources to a higher priority area and the reallocation of resources made to cover budget shortfalls or to meet the budget. And as you recall, the system reallocated $29.3 million of resources in fiscal 14. Most of the reductions were used to actually balance budgets. $18.2 million, 62%, was redirected towards balancing budgets, and that included funding inflationary increases as well.
And Ms. Benders, excuse me, in your packet, members, on the other packet on page 15, lists where things were actually eliminated to hit the numbers. So if you want to follow that as well. Thank you.
And if you don't have any questions, maybe we could.
Let's make that last.
One point that we did want to make is that reallocations is really a standard part of our colleges and universities' financial practices. It happens every year, and we've been reporting on it actually to the legislature for over a decade yet. And we added up the reallocations between 2010 and 2014, so 5 years' worth of data, and colleges and universities reported reallocating $188 million over that time period. So they tend to increase in years when you have a revenue shortfall, either through state appropriation reduction or an enrollment declines, and they when funding is solid, you tend to have a little bit less reallocation. History shows.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just looking at page 15, are these dollars in thousands, millions, what, millions? Okay.
Thousands.
That doesn't make
thousands.
Sense. Well, is it $29 million in savings or?
Yes, $29 million.
Okay, so they're in thousands.
Thousands.
Okay. Good. I was hoping we saved more than $29,000.
But not $29 billion.
But not $29 billion. Right.
Any other questions? Okay, good.
Tuition and fee history and comparison. So this table, we're moving on, again, corresponds to subdivision 7.6 out of the statutory language. It compares tuition and fee rates charged by Minnesota State colleges and universities to rates charged by similar public community and technical colleges and public master's universities in states that border Minnesota and to the national averages. Data use in this comparison is from the IPED system. And each year, U.S. colleges and universities report tuition and fee data to IPEDS, and we are able to compare our rates with similarly classified institutions. So that's where the information comes from. The average tuition and fee rate charged at Minsky universities is slightly lower than the rates charged than the rates charged in similar public universities in states bordering Minnesota, and slightly higher than the national average. The average tuition and fee rate charged at Minsky colleges is higher than rates charged in bordering states and the national average for two-year public colleges. So our universities are a little bit lower than our border states. Our colleges are a little bit higher. Overall, Minsky is not much different from our border states. At the sector level, state universities are slightly lower in cost, so it's $7,610 versus $7,679 at our border states, and while the two-year colleges are slightly higher at $5,371 versus $4,618 at the border. Compared to the nation, the system is above the national average in both sectors. However, historically, this has been the case, and it's based on how states choose to fund their higher education. Minnesota has historically been characterized as a high tuition, high aid state for the two-year colleges in particular.
And Ms. Benner, the two-year is disproportionately higher than our bordering and national, particularly the national, than if you look at the four-year.
Yeah.
So what? Why is that?
Madam Chair, it really is a 30-year-old answer. We've been watching these trends since the merger, and at the time of the merger, this relationship existed. If you compare the tuition rates at the community and technical colleges in 1990 to their national peers, they were above average, and they have stayed above average over the last 30 years. It has its antecedents really in individual state decisions made in the design of their support for higher education, whether it's the presence of a local levy tax or you've watched the debates in California just in the last 5 years. California has moved their university tuition structure towards where we've been for 30 years. It's very variable from one state to the next, and the relationship between our two-year schools and our national comparisons is 30 years old and hasn't moved in all those years.
So Ms. Weidman was explaining to me that many states do have local levy authority for their two-year colleges. Ms. Weidman, anything else you want to say about that?
Madam Chair, I think it's just picking up on what Vice Chancellor King said, that within Minnesota, it's strictly all state dollars and the tuition revenue, and you don't have that additional tax levy revenue coming in to support those schools.
One thing we do want to also point out is that even though we are higher than our neighboring states, the gap has decreased over time. So we have a lower gap today than we did in 2006. So we see some progress on that front. So this next slide illustrates part of the conversation that we had earlier, is what's the relationship between state appropriation and tuition increases. And the graph demonstrates that relationship. Generally, you could see when state funding was reduced, tuition was increased. We also wanted to illustrate that the rate of tuition increases have slowed over recent years when you compare them to the level of increases in fiscal 6 and 7. And our Board of Trustees and the system leaders have made really strong efforts to keep tuition affordable for our students. It's a very strong goal. And most recently, the legislatively funded tuition freeze in fiscal 14 and 15 has helped us, has allowed us to hold tuition rates at fiscal 13 levels. So you can see when the funding increased, the tuition rates dropped off. This next slide is another way to look at the affordability of our colleges and universities. The table illustrates how affordable our colleges and universities are, and then that they continue to be. The table shows the gross undergraduate tuition and fees as a percentage of median family income for a family of four. And by gross, we mean that the tuition and fee cost is measured before the application of any financial aid. So this is just the cost of a two-year education and a four-year education compared to the median family income. And as the chart shows, the state college percentage has been essentially flat from 2011 to 14, and increased less than 1% since 2005. And that's the green line on the bottom. The state university line has increased less than 1% since 2009. It's the red line. And we do know that the financial aid actually lowers the household contribution for a considerable portion of our student. For the colleges in 2012, the 5.7% decreased to 2.8%, and for the universities in 2012, the 7.7% decreased to 4.9%. So just gives another perspective of the way to look at the cost of.
But Ms. Bednar, as you said, that this does not factor in the aid and that offset it. So I appreciate the chart. I don't think it's really a fair snapshot.
Madam Chair, I would offer to you that it overstates the cost to the average household.
That's what I mean.
Right, because it doesn't, as Deb indicated in her remarks, these percentages fall about in half for those two-thirds or so of our students who are financial aid recipients.
And the same would be true. I know the privates would want to come to the table and say, hey, wait a minute, we do a lot to...
Right.
So I just don't want it set on the record that the gap really exists like that, because I think you'd have to look at it in a way where you could factor all that in to really understand that. And so I know we'll be letting the privates come and tell their story, and the university will tell theirs, but...
Fair enough.
Okay.
Fair enough.
This slide presents trends in the graduation transfer out rates that are reported to the U.S. Department of Education for our community and technical colleges. And you've heard the acronym IPEDS. It stands for the Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data System, which is a set of 10 different surveys that all colleges and universities in the U.S. complete each year. So submitting data on students, on degrees, on finances, employees, and the like. All institutions. So it's a national set of standards for calculating this data and reporting it. As the slide indicates, we've seen declines in both the graduation rates and transfer out rates at the state colleges during the last 3 years. And just for your reference, that 2011 rate that we're reporting on the chart is for students who entered the colleges back in the fall of 08, just as the Great Recession was beginning to have an impact. And the rates we're reporting for 2012 and 2013 are for students who entered in 2009 and fall of 2010, so during the depths of the recession. the next slide shows similar rates for our state universities. Although there's been a slight decline in the graduation rates that we report to IPEDS for this most recent group, that overall rate, when you look at transfers as well, has been relatively stable over this period of time. And just to give a little bit of insight on what's been happening with these rates, during the recession, both the colleges and universities experienced very substantial enrollment increases, as I referenced earlier. But as part of that, they also saw very large increases in both the number and the percent of students who were low income, who were from families with low income or independent students with low income. And the colleges also experienced significant increases in the number and percent of students who were not prepared for college, so who came to our colleges and needed to take one or more developmental courses. And our research into graduation and completion rates tells us that both the availability of financial resources for a student and their readiness for college have very significant impacts on their completion rate. For a group of students with an average completion rate of 53%, the students who are from the lowest income families and the least well prepared for college might have a completion rate in the mid to high 30s. And students from the highest income families with fully ready for college might have completion rates in the 60% range. So those two dimensions are so important in understanding what's been happening with our completion rates, but also have really informed our strategies to try to improve completion rates. So we've focused on, focused on affordability. The work with the state grant program to provide additional support to our part-time students. Our foundations have been very active in raising funds for scholarships for our students, and certainly the state appropriations that allow us to freeze tuition have had real impacts on our affordability. On the readiness side, we're pursuing a number of avenues to improve the readiness of students that come to us and or to better improve their readiness when they do come to us. So partnering with Commissioner Caselius and the State Department to provide additional testing in earlier grades so that students and their families know much earlier whether they're on track to be ready for college is the strategy to kind of work up the pipeline to have more prepared students coming to us. In terms of what we're doing in developmental ed, we've got a range of redesign efforts underway that are changing the way we provide developmental ed in order to improve student success in developmental ed and move more students more quickly into our college-level curriculum. So those are kind of at a high level the key strategies that we're pursuing to try to raise our completion rates.
And Mr. Schoenecker, thank you. I know that we'll be having more discussion during the rest of the session. The remediation issue is one that's on the minds of members, and I think you'll see legislation and so we'll want to ask a lot of questions. So thanks for that. Just good. Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Senator Bonoff, Chairman, Chairwoman. Mr. Schoenecker, you mentioned additional testing in E-12 system, and that's certainly something we've kind of scaled back from. So I'm certainly open to better testing and better measurement of testing. Additional testing just seems to always be something we hear from at the local level that not necessarily desired. So just wanted to put that out there. That's certainly something we're going to probably look at and fine-tune and make sure that it's necessary to have additional testing, if at all.
Mr. Schoenecker.
Chair Bonoff, the testing I'm referencing is, I think the State Department has now made the decision to go with ACT suite of tests. So it's not only that test that students typically take in 11th or 12th grade, but it's a parallel test that tells them if they're on track to be ready for college. Okay. So that then students and families can, focus on the subject areas where they're not ready. But I understand the concern about testing and the significant amount of testing that is already underway.
Thank you. And I know we just have a few more minutes because we end at 5:30, so I'll try and stop asking questions. But members, I really appreciate the attentiveness today because it's been a lot of information and it's been really important. So thank you.
I did just want to make a couple of comments about those IPEDS graduation rates that we just looked at. This is, again, a national standard set of definitions. Those rates are reported for first-time full-time students who enter in the fall. So first-time students would be students who have never gone to college after they've graduated from high school. In our system, that population is only about a third or less of our students. So students that are transferring in credits aren't included in the calculation of these rates. PSEO students aren't included in the calculation. And so what we did about 10 years ago is developed another more comprehensive analysis and set of measures that help us understand the patterns of both retention, graduation, and transfer, tracking all of our entering students regardless of whether they're bringing credits or not. And so those are the measures that we use primarily within the system because they are more comprehensive and track all of our students. When we want to do external comparisons, the IPEDS rates are basically the only rates that are available with national standards. But the measures that we typically use within the system are going to be those more comprehensive ones.
And Mr. Schoenecker, do we have the more comprehensive ones in our packet?
We did not include those in this report, but we certainly can make information available.
We'd like to see that. Thank you. And then also, when you give us that information, if you could also give us, I understand that you've done a better job trying to understand where those who transfer end up. Have they graduated from somewhere? And so any information you have, we're interested in.
We certainly Senator Pratt. Can provide something.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schoenecker, as I look at your IPEDS graduation rates, it seems to tie very closely to the six-year graduation rate. But when I look at on page 24 of the larger packet, figure 7.5, we're talking less than a quarter of the students graduating in 4 years at your universities?
Chair Bonoff, Senator Platt, that is correct. What we were required to report in this report is graduation at 4 years, 5 years, and 6 years. Typically, as we talk about comparisons, nationally, the six-year rate is the primary rate that we use. But what this shows is the progress as you're moving from, 4 years after entry to 5 years to 6 years after entry.
Senator Pratt.
Just a comment, Madam Chair, is there's probably a lot to go behind this, but I found this as I was looking through the report to be startling as we talk about college affordability and try and across the system trying to improve four-year graduation rates. I was surprised by this, the jump from 4 to 5 years, and how few students were actually at the universities, which are, you know, I'm based on everything else I've seen, your higher end student. And so I just a comment that I think that's something I'd like to see more information come or analysis on that for this committee.
Senator Pratt, thank you. I'm having a hard time understanding exactly what I'm looking at. So page 25 you're talking about?
24.
Oh, I'm sorry.
24. I didn't understand page 25, so.
Yeah, then 25 is very confusing. Okay, okay. So 4 year, you're down at 21, 23, and then 5 years. So that is a,
right.
That's when we look at costs. And there's no state aid after 4 years.
Absolutely the case that graduation rate impacts costs. It's also the case that at some of our universities, we are predominantly not full-time students. And that's a function of the age of our students and their, to Craig's earlier remarks, their ability to self-finance higher education while they're working. So we'll get some more detailed demographic data about what the university student profile looks like. We can talk more about it.
But Vice Chancellor King, I think to that point I wasn't even thinking about the fact that at the fifth year, there's no Pell Grant and state aid, so no wonder why the ballooning of the debt.
Well, it depends, Madam Chair, on their credit-taking patterns. If they were full-time for 4 years, there's one financial aid consequence. But if they were part-time for 4 years, there's a different financial aid consequence.
Okay. And could you just briefly explain the chart on page 25?
Yes. Another set of rates that are reported to IPEDS are what the standard rate is, what's called 150% rate. So that would be 3 years at a community or technical college to earn an associate degree. So 50% longer than the 2 years that the credential is normally considered to be. And so at a university, the 150% would be 6 years for a baccalaureate degree. But what they're also now requiring us to report is a rate that is 200%. So for a college, that would be 4 years after entry. What is the graduation rate? For a university, that would be 8 years after entry. What is the graduation rate? And so what the comparison of these two bars say is that beyond that 3 years at the colleges or 6 years at the university, the additional numbers of graduations within those groups is not that large. A couple points on that rate.
Thank you.
Next slide.
Oh, Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 24 of the packet, looking at 4, 5, and 6 year graduation rates, do you have any statistics regarding students that take remediation? We know that a large percentage of those students drop out and don't return. I'm just wondering if you have any statistics, how many students taking remediation courses fall into those graphs at all?
Mr. Shoniker.
Chair Bonoff, Senator Clausen, we can certainly provide some information. In some of the analysis we've done, what we find is students that take developmental courses take longer to earn credentials, not surprising. If you've got a student that needs to take a couple of developmental courses, clearly they're going to take a semester or more longer to get to that end point. And the students that don't get there more quickly. The students that take developmental courses also tend to have somewhat higher transfer out rates than students who don't.
And we will spend more committee time on this.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. This slide presents the trends in the number of underrepresented students. that are enrolled at our colleges and universities, and underrepresented students would be students who are students of color or low income and or first generation students. So that would be one or more of those three categories, which tend to be indicators of students that are perhaps more at risk for not completing. And so you can see by these trends that that number of underrepresented students pretty much paralleled our overall enrollment during the last several years, with a peak in 2012, which was about the time when our overall credit enrollment peaked. And this is a slide that just comes back to some of the points that Vice Chancellor King made earlier about the diversity of our students, from you know, majority in Greater Minnesota, students of color 23%, older students, that's also a significant factor in completion rates. Those students tend to be more likely to be students with families, with children, working. 55% of our students are women. 37% are Pell eligible. That's our proxy for low income. Students are eligible for a federal Pell grant. First generation, we have a Minnesota definition, which says that 20% of our students are first generation, and that would be students whose parents have not attended college. There's an alternate definition that's used by the federal government, which is students whose parents have not earned a bachelor's degree, and by that figure, we're at 55% of our students are first-generation students. So in total, about 53%, over half of our students are underrepresented, and we serve about 11,000 veterans a year. And this is the last slide from the required legislative report, showing our trend in revenues for customized training, and that would be primarily the non-credit kinds of courses we spoke about earlier, either provided through a contract with an employer, or some of them are open enrollment where employees may come and pay the tuition, or ultimately their employer reimburses them for tuition.
The final slide, Madam Chair, just to end on a high note, just calls out for you our ranking nationally on administrative spending. It wasn't something that was asked for in the session law, and we think it's worth drawing to your attention because we get questions about it every year. We have averaged in the 37th to 40th in the country over these last 6 or 7 years, which is to say that 36 other state systems spend more on administration per FYE than MNSCU does. Our spending levels are below all of our border states, and have sat down in that zone now for years. System-wide administrators, which is a HR classification, account for about 3% of our employees. And on an FTE basis, the number of administrators has fallen from 2009 to 2014. So with that, Madam Chair, I think we've run a little long here. Thank you very much for a terrific conversation about the information, and we will work with Dave to assemble all the questions and come back to you with the information that you and your members have requested.
Well, thank you for your well-informed presentation, and thank you again, members, for your attention and conversation. It was very productive.
Thank you.
2 minutes.
Committee's adjourned. So on Thursday, members, we will meet and review the University of Minnesota.